Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Debra and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. I'm Dr. Debra.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly. How you doing, lovey?
Oh, I'm okay. As you know, this is a big day. I'm actually sitting in my car. I'm remote today because after our show, I go back to the vet to find out how Mr. Prowls is doing. If he's improved from this latest round of chemo treatment, then we will keep on going with the same program. And if he's stayed the same or not, there's one final option that we'll try. That's a monthly chemo. So I'm a little nervous and also hopeful. So
yes.
I know you love that little guy so much. It's
so
my kitty cat.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Prowler is Deborah's cat. I mean, the most gorgeous cats I've ever seen in my life. They are delicious. And he's just so sweet. He's a sweet, sweet guy. So we'll say prayers. And I'm actually glad you're doing the show because it can kind of help distract you a little bit, I imagine, just from that waiting.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. It's good because right now, no news is bad news.
It's
right?
True.
I haven't had anything. So there we go.
That's very true.
And how about you? How are you? You have some big meeting today?
Oh,
or
my God. I've had like the most intense week so far, and it's Tuesday. I had my older son's individualized education plan in school. I had a court mediation for my second son for his IEP today. So it's been it's been intense. Tomorrow, though, I'm actually excited. I'm going to give a work-life balance presentation to Los Angeles LAX workers. So that should be kind of cool. But it's probably perfect timing because it is. It's really hard to balance your family life and your work life. I mean, it's a stress for everybody I know. So we all could use some tips on how to maintain more balance in our lives.
Absolutely. Did you have a good weekend?
I did. What did I do this weekend? I'm trying to think. It's so funny. I can't even remember what I ate for breakfast, let alone what I did a couple of days ago. What did I do this weekend? What was it? Oh yeah. My friends from San Diego came up, and a friend of mine, it was his 40th birthday party. And what's really cool about this guy is I've known him since second grade. He's from back in my hometown, and he keeps in touch with everyone and their mother. So I literally felt like I was at a elementary school reunion. I mean, I saw people. I haven't seen people in years. He's really good at keeping in touch, and that's kind of his MO, is just kind of keeping those connections alive. And so it was wonderful. I mean, I saw this guy from my neighborhood who I haven't seen in probably 25 years. And it was just really, really cool and bonding and exciting. So I had a really good weekend. What about you?
Oh, fun. Yeah. Well, we're sort of full fledged moving forward and learning about this real estate investment stuff.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's a little scary. It's interesting. This last weekend was the full immersion weekend. We actually went out with this group and they taught you how to evaluate a property and what profit margins there would be. And if you're flipping or wholesaling. So it's like a whole new world. It's going to be like a whole different
hobby, right?
For me, I guess.
Yeah. That's what I love about you. I probably said this last time, but I love that you're so passionate about learning new things. And I feel like when you take it on really well and you do really well. So I'm excited for you for this journey. I think it's going to be great.
Thanks, honey.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about last week's show. We had Kevin Murphy, former Wall Street Managing Director for Citigroup, high school and collegiate wrestling champion, community activist, speaker. What's that? What is a speaker? Okay, a speaker, coach, and author of the book, The Three Rooms. Basically talking about which room are you in? Are you more in the past? Are you in the present? Or are you in the future? Mm-hmm. And how to maneuver back closer to the present most of the time.
Well, I think it was just really reassuring to know, like, okay, you can be in all the different rooms at different times, different moments. And I think we all do that. And just that reminder to stay present. It's really interesting show. And if you miss that and want to feel like you want to get more present in your life or understand why you ruminating on the past or anxious about the future, it's a really, really great book to look into. It's called The Three Rooms.
Absolutely. And this week, which is why I didn't want to have the news about Prowler before the show, because we're going to be talking about happiness. Today, we have Jonathan Rauch, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, the author of 6 books and many articles on public policy, culture, and government. A recipient of the 2005 National Magazine Award, he's a contributing editor of The Atlantic. His writing has appeared in the New York Republic, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post, among many other publications. He lives with his husband in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Jonathan.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
I am so excited.
Yeah, we're
to talk about this book right now. Sorry, Deborah. I'm like already cutting you off.
Yeah, so I realized, I realized I didn't actually mention the title of the book. The book is called The Happiness Curve.
Yes.
Not The Happiness Cure, but The Happiness Curve. Why Life Gets Better After 50. I love it. So excited. Why don't you tell us about what inspired you to write this book?
Me, my life. So I was someone who did just great. Until I was about 50, I was lucky. I had good health, good income. I hit all my career goals. I exceeded them. Yet, starting in my late 30s, I began to feel a sense of disappointment and underachievement and failure, which was inexplicable. And it got actually gradually worse. And even when I won the biggest award that a magazine journalist can get in the United States, that turned me around for about 10 days. And then these feelings crept back. I didn't understand what was going on. I became kind of scared about that, anxious. You know, why was I not feeling rewarded about life? Toward the end of that period in my late 40s, 10 years ago, I'm now 58, I came across this new science coming out of economics of all places that finds this so-called U-shaped happiness curve where contentment tends to bottom out in midlife, not only in humans, but in chimps and orangutans. And that's when I realized I needed to understand this because lots of people go through it.
So this is fascinating. So they're saying, okay, you start off, you know, really happy and then you kind of hit this mid 40s and you kind of go into a depression or, you know, a low point and then you rise again after 50. That's basically what it's saying.
Yeah, but with a very important caveat. This doesn't necessarily describe your life. Because lots of things affect how you're going to feel about your life. You know, do you get a Nobel Prize? Do you get cancer? Do you star in a Broadway play? All of those things matter. But the nature of this discovery, what's really interesting and counterintuitive about it, is it turns out that all by itself, the aging process, just the process of growing older over time, has an effect on how easy or hard it is for you to be happy. And the way that effect works is other things being equal, aging is going to fight life satisfaction and until you're at about age 50, and then it's going to switch sides. And what that means is that a lot of people for whom other things are going smoothly, so they're not having the cancer or the, you know, the Broadway debut, they're like me, they're going to really feel the effects of this undertow, but they're not going to know why. And the reason is it's not something wrong with your marriage, usually, or your job. You're not failing as a human being. It's a natural change in our brains and our values as we age.
That's fascinating. And does that have any impact on the divorce rate? You say it doesn't mean that you're necessarily dissatisfied in your marriage. But I think so many marriages end in people's 40s because they want to, you know, fly the nest and see if there's other better options out there. Do you think if more people stuck that out by knowing this, there would be fewer divorces?
Well, yes, you're correct. This is a time in life when a lot of marriages will flounder, and there are multiple reasons for that. But one lesson to be learned from this is humans turn out to be really bad at understanding on any given day what makes us happy and unhappy. And I don't mean like your mood. Like, are you cheerful or sad right now? I mean, do you feel satisfied with your life? That's the kind of happiness we're talking about. So what I felt like I was going to needed to do was quit my job and run away. I blame this feeling of restlessness and disappointment on my job, but my job had nothing to do with it. My job was great. Some people flounder around and blame these feelings on their marriage, and they leave a marriage or they leave key relationships. And that turns out not to help, because of course they just carry this time-related dissatisfaction with them after the divorce. So the challenge here is to understand, beware of sudden radical changes in midlife. You may need to make a change in midlife, but being disruptive is usually not your friend in midlife. It's easy to make a mistake.
That makes sense.
So, very interesting.
Well, what's interesting to me is Oprah has always said that every decade she feels better. And so I'm wondering if you can speak to a little bit about maybe emotional regulation as we get older. And do you settle down? Like, I remember when I was in my 20s, super self-conscious and, you know, yes, I'm young and you have fun, but I didn't feel like I was comfortable with who I am. So I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about the research on that front.
Yeah, I would love to. There were two big surprises I learned in researching this book. One, midlife malaise, midlife crisis, whatever you want to call it, is very often about nothing. It's like the Seinfeld show. And that's what we just discussed. It's actually changes in your brain, changes in your values, a normal transition. It's not about you or your life in many cases. So that's the first surprise. The second surprise is that all our stereotypes about aging and happiness are wrong. The emotional peak of life, on average, is in the last decades of life. Not in youth, which we glorify as a time of excitement. Not middle age, which we glorify as a time of mastery. So if we're not doing great in midlife, you know, that's supposed to be a crisis. It's actually in our 60s and 70s or beyond. We get better as we age at emotional regulation. As you mentioned, we experience less regret. We experience less stress in any given situation. We feel more positivity. And all of this stuff and much more has actually been shown in brain scans comparing older brains and younger brains.
Wow.
Emotionally aging is good for you.
Mm. It is so true. Our society always talks about how youth is so great and we miss it. We miss those days and everything like that. It's fascinating.
Yeah. And then when you actually interview people, when I interviewed them for my book and when scientists do it, very few people want to go back to their 20s. You know, they may want those that hairline, or they may want those knees, but they don't want the emotional volatility, the uncertainty, the stress, the storm and drang.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can certainly attest to that myself. You and I are of similar age, Jonathan, and I often experience that same piece that you're talking about, that like when I really look at how much more grounded I am and confident and secure and, you know, fewer things rock me like they used to. You know, I don't get put off edge as much as I used to. And so, Kelly, you have me to look up to now.
Yeah.
I'm always looking up to you. the hell with that.
Exactly. Wow. So I guess, God, I have a lot of like more questions. So what about when they say that the highest suicide rate is for, don't they say the highest suicide rate is for like seniors in their 60s or something like that? And so what is this conflicting research? How can you speak to that?
The latest statistics I just saw, new work on this, finds actually suicide is highest in midlife in both the U.S. and the U.K. And the deaths of despair, which we're all reading about, that's suicide plus addiction and drinking and so forth. Those are also peaking in middle age. There are a lot of indicators that midlife is a time of difficulty and vulnerability for lots of people. And it's also a time, if you think about it, when we have the least amount of structure and support for people. Young people have school, college, and then they have grad school and they're starting careers and they're regularly mentored. And then older people also have a fair amount of structure in the form of retirement. But in midlife, we're supposed to be master of the universe. You know, we're supposed to know how to answer every question, solve every problem. We consider it a form of weakness in midlife if we're not taking great care of our parents, taking great care of our kids at the pinnacle of our careers, you know, solving everybody's problems. And so if we're not, then we can often just feel like failures and we don't have people to reach out to. And that, by the way, is what happened to me. I let myself get isolated with my dissatisfaction in middle age because I was ashamed of it. I thought, I have so much to be grateful for, yet I'm not grateful. I'm some kind of whiner. So I shut it all in, and that makes it much worse.
Wow. This is amazing. Deborah, with your friends... Go ahead. I was just going to say, have you noticed with your friends that they kind of hit this low and then they kind of got out of it? I'm just curious what your experience is.
It's a good question. I'm going to have to give that some thought because I haven't really been thinking about observing people in that way. But I certainly have a fair amount of friends who are in their, you know, mid-50s and mid-60s who actually do seem just more stable and grounded and kind of just content with regular day-to-day stuff. Also, to some degree, having much more realistic expectations of how the world is supposed to work, how they're supposed to work, what life's supposed to give them, and a sort of a greater sense of inner control and power. I guess that's probably how I would answer that. So it's fascinating. I'm gonna look at that more deeply in my relationships with my friends to see what they are experiencing. I was curious in this research that you're talking about, and this may just be too off track here, but so a lot of people who suffer from clinical depression, are they then at an advantage when they get older because just naturally the brain is going to help them better to make them less depressed?
Well, first of all, I want to say everything you just said in that beautiful paragraph about what you've just encountered, if we wrote down that paragraph and analyzed it clause by clause, everything you just said is dead on scientifically accurate about the changes that happen as we age. There's empirical support for all of it. And that's kind of revolutionary. This is what you've been seeing in your patients is now supported in the science and shows that the aging process is not at all the process of decline and loss and tragedy and depression that we'd assume. It is a time when our expectations have become more moderate, which actually helps us feel grateful. It reduces ambition, but it improves gratitude, which is good for well-being. And it's a time when we focus more on the things that matter most to us. So we prune away the secondary things. We focus on our core activities and relationships, which is really good for well-being. It's all the other things that you said. So I wish I'd written that down. So a clinical depression, well, you guys are the guys who actually, you're clinicians, right?
Yes.
Yes.
So you guys are the people to answer that question because I did not explore acute clinical psychiatric and psychological issues. And those are on a separate grid. So what I'm talking about here with the happiness curve is not acute depression. And in fact, that's important to know because when I felt midlife dissatisfaction, what I say is it's not an emotional disorder. It's a satisfaction disorder. It's about how I evaluated my life. But it didn't feel appropriate for me to go seek medical help and get on meds for depression because it wasn't like that. I was perfectly functional. My mood was just fine, except in the mornings. Mm-hmm. But I just felt like I had lost the capacity for gratitude. So that's not depression, right? That's something else. The other difference is acute depression is by its very definition a crisis. Whereas, and that's, you know, when we talk about midlife crisis, that's the idea. This is a big, disruptive, damaging thing. But what we're talking about here is a natural life transition, completely healthy to go through, unpleasant, but it's a transition in our values and in our brains and in our expectations toward a different view of the world. It's a realignment. It's a little bit, people liken it to adolescence in that respect. Can often be unpleasant for people going through it, and isn't always. Some people do great, but can often be unpleasant. But it's got a destination. And the same thing is true of the happiness curve. It's leading us through a transition from our early years of ambition and social competition to our new later life set of values, the ones you just discussed, the ones that are about connection and compassion and community, with a nasty transition in between. So, no, we shouldn't think of this as a medical problem.
And I'm curious, with the research you've done, what you've noticed about the United States versus other countries and how they view the elderly. I find this fascinating. And I don't know if that came across, you know, just by accident or something that you've researched, but I'm just curious.
It's something I was exposed to incidentally, because one of the things the book is about is once we start correcting the stereotype of age as a time of, you know, loss and depression and loneliness and sadness and grief, and then you die, what you realize is that what we're getting now is the greatest gift in the history of the human species, which is 10, 15, eventually 20, maybe more years of healthy life in the most satisfying pro-social part of life, the 60s, 70s, 80s, it'll be 90s eventually. And we're not utilizing that. In America, the social model for elderly, to get to your question, is basically you retire from work, you go out, chew grass in the pasture, and then you die. Well, that's not what people want to do anymore. They're vigorous. So what we need to do, and especially in America, but also in other countries, is start work on these new models of aging, which are already emerging, second careers. They're called encore careers, mentoring, volunteering, careers that are less demanding on the clock, but involve more in terms of giving back to the community. People are starting businesses now later in life. And those changes are already starting to happen. One difference, to go to your question, between the U.S. and some other Western countries and traditional countries is we segregate our elderly. That's actually a fairly recent thing, you know, having old age homes and old age communities, you know, senior living, all that stuff. That's not how human beings are designed to live. It looks like, we don't know yet, but the best conjecture is, okay, so why would evolution put us through this process of difficult readjustment in midlife to new values? Well, humans are one of only about three or four species that greatly outlive their fertility. Other species, if you can't reproduce, your dead weight and evolution kills you off. That's not true of human women. Why not? Because it seems like having elders in the mix for humans and orca whales and pilot whales and a few other species improves the chances for their children and their grandchildren. It's called the grandmother effect. So having the old elders in the mix with the younger people turns out to be good for the younger people, good for the elders, good for the whole population, and we've cut ourselves off from that. It's just the beginnings of a new movement now. Mark Friedman is leading it. He's about to publish a great book on this called How to Stay Young Forever, about finally breaking down that age segregation, because it was a great historical mistake.
Wow. That is so fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing that. My gosh, that's definitely
going
to be—
I'm just sorry about the long answer. I feel like I broke the syllabus record there. But
it was so fascinating. But I want to take us in line with what you're saying. Clearly, a lot of marketing people, advertisers, do not understand this. And the dominant billboards, commercials, et cetera, that you see are, you know, older, sophisticated men with way younger, sexy women on fast cars and all that, really perpetuating the stereotype that you're going to be happier when you dump the old broad and bring in the new one. Can you speak to that a little bit?
It's funny you ask, because just last week I got a call from a marketing agency whose client is a major international sportswear company. Wouldn't say which one it is, so I don't know. But they were actually interested in doing some marketing and brand campaigning about the reality of aging, starting to understand that the stereotypes that you just mentioned are wrong. So yeah, part of what's gone on here is that we, in the culture and in commerce, in advertising, just on TV, we tend to treat youth as, you know, a great, exciting, funny, marvelous period. And we tend to portray older age as kind of a throwaway time, or a time when you're crotchety, or, you know, a lovable old guy or woman. You know, think about Golden Girls or Frasier, or, you know, Archie Bunker and so forth. So I think some of that will change naturally, because as baby boomers age, they're going to shed and reject a lot of those stereotypes. But there is a lot more work to be done.
Mm. Wow.
Well, good. I'm glad you're saying that, because that's been a point of contention for me for so long, because I've worked with so many women with eating disorders and body image issues, and it's always feeling like they're up against the clock and that things are just never going to get better. And so that's hopeful, at least. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah, this is.
Yeah, and it's important to realize we can talk a bit about what to actually do if you find yourself in a midlife slump. One of the most helpful things is simply knowing that what you're going through, if you find yourself in this situation, is, as we said, natural, normal, healthy. Similar phenomenon has been observed in chimps and orangutans. So it's not even just human. It's a primate phenomenon. And most important, in most cases, it ends all by itself. It goes away. It's a stage, and it's actually leading you to a period of surprising contentment, where that nastiness of waking up every day and feeling disappointed turns into a period that goes on right until the end of your life, of assuming nothing has gone horribly wrong, of waking up every morning and thinking, wow, I'm more content today than I ever expected to be. Mm. Nothing's automatic, but that's the way the time works. So wait it out. If you're in a slump, don't do anything stupid. It gets better.
So we've been talking with Jonathan Rauch. He is the author of The Happiness Curve, Why Life Gets Better After 50. Wow, this is so interesting. Wow. Oh my gosh. Okay, so I guess my other question for you is, I mean, I guess, how do people in general define happiness? I'm just really curious, like, what have you come across?
Great question. So there's two, instead of talking about people in general, it may be more helpful to think of this as, how has happiness science come to think that people talk about happiness and think about it? Because there's been tons of research on this, and it really boils down to some fairly simple things. Basically, there are two standard things that people mean when they talk about happiness. The first is called affective happiness. And that's basically how you're feeling right now. You know, your mood, your emotional state at present. And that's easy to gauge, because you give people questionnaires and clickers and things. You know, you survey them by text, with questions like, how many times did you smile today? How much stress are you feeling right now? How much worry are you feeling? Well, there's an entirely separate definition of happiness. It's called evaluative happiness, and that's what we've been talking about on this show. Evaluative happiness is your satisfaction with your life as a whole, as opposed to your mood at present. Very different concept. How fulfilled do I feel with my life? And it turns out that's also easy to measure, and has been measured now for decades, going back to the 50s, with questions like, overall, how satisfied do you feel with your life on a scale of 1 to 10? And that question has been asked of millions and millions of people in countries representing 99.something% of the population of the world. Turns out people have no problem distinguishing the two senses of happiness. And it won't surprise you to hear that in the long term, the second one, how you evaluate your life, is much more important overall to your emotional well-being than just sort of day-to-day mood. So that's the one to really target. And that's the one policymakers and and scientists who are thinking about this are increasingly focusing on how do you get people's sense of well-being up.
Mm. It's nice that you say that, because I think a lot of people do get consumed with judging. They don't have that question in their mind of what's my overall satisfaction like. They're thinking like, I don't feel good right now. I'm not happy right now. I don't like what my boss just said to me, and getting fixated on that minutia, that moment-to-moment thing, and then actually using that as the quantitative or qualitative measure of their life satisfaction. So I really like how you're sort of changing the perspective.
Me too.
On how to look at that. Thank you so much for pointing that out. I'm gonna put that in my wheelhouse too. Thank you.
Yeah.
Something I've been asked fairly frequently as I talk about the book and the ideas in the book is people say, well, is it really even that important to be happy? I mean, people can be too happy. They can just loaf off. You want them to like be dissatisfied sometimes. Mm. And I say, well, no, that's missing the point. Yeah, you don't want people to be in a cheerful mood all the time, because then they'd be on drugs or anesthetized. But you do want people to feel satisfied with their lives most of the time. Mm. Even though people who are satisfied with their lives will wake up some of the time and feel low or depressed or frustrated, because they'll have reasons to feel that way.
True.
Wow.
So you are pointing out, we haven't had this question at you directly, but the difference between happiness, unhappiness, and a midlife crisis. I think you're defining that a midlife crisis really is. It's a crisis. It's something that's very powerfully changing in a moment, as opposed to this happiness curve being really about a natural biological, biochemical evolution. Did I get that one right? Close?
Yep.
Okay.
That's right.
Kelly, have you ever had I was going to ask Kelly, have you ever had a midlife crisis, do you think?
I'm only 40. For sure. Oh my God. I mean, it's really funny because I feel like I would say 39 to 40, I kind of started to, I don't know, I just started to reevaluate things. I wanted more fun in my life. And my friend of mine said, like, are you having a midlife crisis? I mean, she literally used those words. And I think it's important to kind of have those moments, because it does make you change things or be more motivated. So I actually don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's super helpful in a lot of ways. So I would say mine happened quite recently. What about you?
Well, I've always steered clear of the word midlife crisis, because for me, a crisis is literally my life is collapsing and falling apart.
Yeah.
So I've always looked at those moments as a midlife evaluation and a midlife change in perspective, and then allowing that road to open up in front of me to try to see which direction I want to take. And that's the only way I can stay grounded in something like that. Otherwise I get too agitated. So that's kind of my version of that.
Mm. Super fascinating.
So question for Kelly.
Yes.
What was a crisis about your crisis? Was your life disrupted in some way? Did you experience a sudden shock or jolt?
So, I mean, and I've shared this on the radio. So I have two boys who I love dearly. They both have ADHD. So our house is a complete and total chaos and screaming and just madness. And I don't know. I mean, I think it was the combination of turning 40 and what does this mean, and also like, okay, you know, do I, you know, I dedicated so much of my life to my kids and kind of what I was saying at the beginning of the show, and kind of getting them the services that they need in school and the resources and the accommodations. So it's sort of this question of like, okay, is it kind of my turn now to have a little bit more joy in my life now that my kids are getting a little bit older? And how can I celebrate life versus before I was just so focused on my kids and getting them what they needed? So that was kind of the catalyst.
But where's the crisis? Because it sounds like what you were doing was a healthy reevaluation.
That makes sense.
That did not cause a crisis.
Right.
When I think crisis, I think you leave your marriage, for example, or you find yourself you quit a job, or you some kind of upheaval. Did you experience anything like that?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think I just added a lot more going out and being social. And so it wasn't a crisis. It was a positive thing. I think it was just such a shift. So that's, yeah, but I'll substitute the word crisis for shift for me, because I think you're right.
I think that was kind of what I was trying to say, too, is I think in our society, we've given this big label called midlife crisis to so many people. It's like carte blanche to define things that way, that becomes our mindset and our mentality. And that's why I think it is so critical that we look at these things from a different perspective of, you know, transformation, evolution, mm-hmm. You know, new desires, I guess putting them in a positive way, even when we speak with our clients to try to help them see those things in that way, right? I mean, I think that's a lot of value in what you're saying, Jonathan.
That's so important. And it's so important for clinicians and therapists to convey that to other people. The reason, Kelly, that I was pushing back on mm-hmm. on your use of midlife crisis, right now the only template that we have socially to talk about these issues that come up in midlife is the midlife crisis idea. So that idea came along as recently as 1965. It's a very recent idea. And then it took off in pop culture, thanks to Gail Sheehy and some other things. And then psychologists went looking for midlife crisis, and they never found it. They didn't find that disruption is any more common, or breakdown is any more common in midlife than any other time. Now, we have to caveat that today, because now we see we've got suicide and deaths of despair peaking in midlife. But generally, they didn't find midlife crisis. So then we're left in a situation, well, what about someone like Kelly?
Yeah.
Who needs to make some adjustments in her life because her values are starting to change. Mm-hmm. What's the template for that? How do we describe that in a way that suggests continuity and good health instead of disruption and brokenness? Because what you're going through is not only natural, but exactly what the textbook says needs mm-hmm. to happen in midlife. It's a time when our values begin to shift away. We begin questioning what we've been doing, often on a treadmill.
Right.
Since our 20s, trying to get ourselves established, trying to hit all those social goals, trying to climb the greasy ladder, get ahead in life, meet our ambitions. Mm-hmm. Psychologists call that the hedonic treadmill. Because that process of constantly trying to achieve and perfect turns out to be self-defeating. Mm. We never do meet those goals because the goalposts keep moving. And by midlife, we're feeling disappointed and restless, but we're also in a great place to start reevaluating. Mm. So what needs to happen at midlife is therapists and clinicians and coaches and friends need to stop saying, "Hey, Kelly, oh, you must be having your midlife crisis. When are you going to get the convertible?"
Yeah.
And they need to start understanding this is a time when adults are going through a change in their developmental process. It's healthy, and we need to provide resources for that. You know, what do you need? As where do you want your life to go, and how can we align your values with that? Mm. And that's going to mean, it could mean gap years for middle-aged people. It could mean we should let people take a year out of their Social Security to go back to school. It could just mean making the kinds of personal adjustments you talked about, focusing more on mm-hmm. some things and less on others. But it's not a crisis.
I love that.
And just for our, it's beautiful. Just for our listeners' sake, too, because I imagine, Kelly, you and I have some listeners who really do feel like their lives are in shambles and that they are in some sort of a crisis. And by all of our embracing of that, if you are in some kind of crisis, if you're in an abusive relationship, or you know, you've just lost a child or a spouse to suicide, or there's been some major destructive forces occurring in your life, please don't think that we are minimizing that in any way, and that this is really just about maybe seeing this as getting to the other side. Mm-hmm. You know, so if somebody is in a crisis, get help, get services, have someone help you put things in perspective and solve those immediate acute problems in this moment.
Right.
That's so important. And it's also, I guess it's good to say this on the show with a couple clinicians, but a mistake a lot of people make, and I think looking back, I made this mistake, is they don't reach out for support and guidance. It turns out in this period of life, there's a lot going on, and life doesn't come with a sign that says, okay, 55% of what you're feeling right now is because of the natural aging process. It's fine, it goes away. But 35% is because of serious problems with your marriage, and the remaining 10% is because you need a raise. Hmm. That's not how it works. it turns out human beings are not good at sifting through our lives and evaluating all these things. And it is good to reach out to others in order first to try to surface these issues. Coaching is, I did a deep dive on coaching for my book. Coaching is really good for this because it's non-medical. It's not about fixing something that's broken. It's about helping you discover and realize your values mm-hmm. and aligning your life. But these days, many therapists understand the science that's emerging about the stresses of midlife and won't tell you you're sick, there's something wrong with you, here's some meds. Other people who have been through it or who are trained can help sort through these issues and help you understand, okay, do I have depression? Do I seriously need a massive change in my life? Or am I going through something that's normal and natural that'll work itself out? But don't try to solve that completely on your own.
Yeah, I think that's super important. Wow. I want to
so eloquent you are.
Yes. Oh my God. Well, that's what I was just going to say. I want to shift gears for 1 second, and I'd love to hear more about the other things that you have written about and worked on, because I imagine Deborah and I are both going to be super fascinated by it. But maybe you could just give us kind of a brief intro. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm a journalist by training and inclination, which means I know a little about a lot of things, but a lot about nothing. So at the moment, things that are close to my heart besides this, which is, as you can tell, super close to my heart, mm-hmm. I'm all about reinventing the model of adult development, which is being transformed under our very eyes. Apart from that, I work on something a lot that I call political realism, which is how hacks, machines, big money, and backroom deals can strengthen our democracy. Mm. Most of the political reforms of the last 40, 50 years have made things worse, not better, in the view of me and a bunch of other people. So I'm involved in that. I'm working, we just published an article in National Affairs called The Constitution of Knowledge. Mm. And that's about how we find truth in a free society and why trolls and the president, in some respects, mm-hmm. and others are undermining the processes we use to find truth and how to fight back. That's called The Constitution of Knowledge at nationalaffairs.com. I've worked for years on gay issues, and I've got a piece in the works on why I don't like the term LGBT. Mm. And want to just call myself Q from now on. People will go along with that. I'd like to popularize that. So I just do all kinds of things. I think a lot about polarization. I'm part of an effort that you guys will probably enjoy called Better Angels. I'm on the board. This is a national grassroots depolarizing campaign based around the premise that people are more divided by politics than ever, but part of that is because we don't encounter each other. So we've got communities across the country putting together groups of blues and reds who meet in structured conversations.
Oh, wow.
The motto is come as you are, leave as you are. No one's going to be lobbied. No one's going to be expected to change their mind. But it's about finding each other as humans and learning to humanize each other across these divides. And that's taking off like wildfire all across the country. And that's super gratifying because we have such a problem right now with animosity and polarization. So that's a handful of the stuff I get to do.
This is I knew I'd find it fascinating.
Oh, that's awesome.
This is amazing.
Oh, my goodness.
And
yeah, check out Better Angels because it's grassroots. Everyone can get involved right there in your community.
Wow. And it just it, like you
better-angels.org.
Okay. And you have.
Repeat, better-angels.org. Enough with advertisement, but it's a really cool thing.
And
really
so
inspiring.
You sit down, you can have meetings with people. Is that basically what it is? And to kind of learn about other people's views?
Yeah, but it's structured. Mm-hmm. You guys would relate to this. The idea was originally built by a famous, actually a professor who's a famous marital therapist, who kind of said, well, look, if we can have structured conversations that can help people break through some of these very tough personal issues, can we apply that to politics? And discovered that in the course of anywhere from a couple hours to a full day, the sessions can vary. If you have a conversation with certain rules about people don't even, on the blues and reds don't even talk directly to each other until about halfway through. until they've established some trust. But then once they do, they love it. They begin to learn how to relate to each other without the eyeball rolling, without listening, so that you're listening in order to refute, which is, let's face it, the way most of us listen when we talk about politics. It's, how am I going to refute this? And then once they've had a taste of that, then they go off and start more Better Angels groups, because it can be a transformative experience to relearn how to listen.
Oh, I love this.
That is awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that. And now, believe it or not, we just have a few more minutes left. So is there anything from our discussion today, our chat with you, that we missed a key point that you want to share with our audience?
Boy, you just covered so much. I think we pretty much got it all. I guess I could mention, I have some tips in the book for people who are experienced one of these bouts of midlife malaise. And we covered a number of them, but it's worth reiterating.
Okay.
First, don't go it alone. This should not be a DIY project. Second, understand it's normal, natural, and healthy. Normalize it. Don't pathologize what you're going through. Don't think you're having a moral breakdown. Number three, understand that it's going to end. This is not forever. It wasn't for me. Mine turned around when I was about 50. I'm a textbook case. Even though my life objectively got worse, the fog started lifting. Stay in the present. Don't obsess about the past or future. Meditation is good for that, but there are other ways to do it. Cognitive behavioral interventions, like just when you find yourself leaning to start comparing yourself unfavorably with other people, which happens a lot at this stage, just cut that off. Interrupt that inner dialogue. Learn a catchphrase, like in my case, it was no comparison. So you gain control of the inner conversation. So there's a lot you can do in this situation that will help move through the transition. The transition is just there. The only way out is through, if you're a person going through this. Not everyone will. But if you are, the transition is just there. But it can be a lot easier if you reach out to others and follow these other tips.
You are such
amazing.
An inspiring
articulate,
bright. Oh, I just loved having you on.
Well, I should come on more often, because you guys have given me more compliments in this hour than I've probably had all year.
Oh, that's
really
lovely.
Funny.
So Jonathan Rauch, The Happiness Curve, Why Life Gets Better After 50. Where can people find you and where can they get a copy of the book?
HappinessCurveBook.com is the website. It's at all major retailers, including Amazon. And I've also got a personal webpage, www.jonathanrausch.com, which has lots of my writings on lots of the subjects we discussed. And everyone, please go have a look at Better Angels, because it may be something that you want to get involved with. A lot of people are excited about it. That's better-angels.org.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Oh, you are great. And next week we have Iris Ben-Ruby. She's the creator of a video summit, Let Love In. And she's going to come speak to us about attachment styles and how that impacts our relationships. And then just a little plug for myself, too. I'm actually a featured expert in the Let Love In summit.
So oh, my God. That's great.
A little self-promotion there too.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, everybody. Follow us on Instagram. It's at 2TWOShrinks. Our Facebook is the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show. Our website is docandtherapist.com. And thank you so much for listening. We'll see you guys next week.
Bye-bye. Love you.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.